Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello, Catherine here. Before we launch into this week's podcast, I just want to tell you two things. Firstly, for anyone dreaming of writing their own creative non-fiction book, maybe a memoir, travelogue or family history, my online course, Writing Your True Story, launches in September. For more information, click the link in the show notes. Secondly, this is the last episode in the current series as I'm taking a pause during August to get some writing done. If you've not listened to all the episodes already, now's your chance to binge. But first of all, enjoy my conversation with the brilliant Ramona Ali. Hello and welcome to the Wintering Sessions with me, Catherine May. Each week I talk to a writer who's experienced a wintering period where they felt frozen out of the world. And this week I'm delighted to introduce journalist and broadcaster Ramona Ali. Welcome, Ramona.
Hi, Catherine, and thanks for having me. Oh, I know we tried before. And then we went into a two-hour chat.
we should own up to
catch up.
There's a whole load of stuff we need to own up to, isn't there, at the beginning of this podcast? Because, first of all, we tried this once before and it just failed. And you ended up...
Or succeeded, depending on how you look at it.
It was lovely. I had the best time. And you ended up sitting in your wardrobe talking to me for like 2 hours.
I'm back in my wardrobe again.
I love this vision of you in your wardrobe. But that is because we went to school together by some weird coincidence.
Many years ago. We went to the same school in Kent and in Rochester. And I think we reconnected many years later. I think you connected with me on Twitter.
Well, I saw you be retweeted or something on Twitter and I recognised the name instantly. But because I'm face blind, of course, I had no idea if it was you or not. And I spent a little while looking at faces and thought, nope, not a clue. And so I sent you a tweet like, are you the Ramona that I went to school with?
It was so cool. That was such a lovely moment, actually. I was like, oh my goodness, because obviously your surname has changed.
And I was like,
wow, she's this big hotshot. I knew she would always be that.
Because
I mean, at school, I was just so in awe of you. You're so confident and so clever.
I think nothing's
really changed in that regard.
Oh, yeah, obviously. I mean, you know, I'm just exuding cleverness when I'm in the 20 minutes that we've just spent for me trying to sort the sound out on my podcast. can't even do the basics, honestly.
Look, you're doing a podcast. This is amazing. And the book that I've been reading, Wintering, as well. It's just so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
So beautiful. Oh. And what you're doing is just so brilliant. Just like talking to different people about wintering sessions, wintering periods.
I'm loving
it. It really resonates. It was amazing. Yeah. I've been listening to them. So yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Oh no, well, it's so lovely to be there. And it was lovely last time to catch up on, like, what is it, 20 years worth of, more than 20 years worth of life.
Yeah, 20 years and 2 hours. It was full throttle, wasn't it?
Yeah, I learned a lot. But I think, I guess we don't ever expect to be part of an old girls network going to a state school. And it's just always so lovely to talk to someone that's in the same, you know, industry as you anyway. But when you've got history with that person, it's amazing. So, so exciting.
It is. It's so exciting. It's just so wonderful sitting in my wardrobe talking to Catherine.
I know.
Gagey, as was.
Yes.
From school.
I know. I could never have written under that surname because no one could ever pronounce it. So you're probably one of the few people who can actually do it, which is really exciting.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So since I knew you at school, you have become a kind of uber journalist and broadcaster on Muslim spirituality. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. Yeah, so on faith, on identity, lifestyle, culture. I've really kind of really like been interested in exploring like what people believe, how they feel, their spirituality, and just like, you know, everything to do with life, because it's just very holistic. I see faith is very holistic, and you know, it's not in a vacuum. So there's so many sides to who I am, my personality and my writing, and I just wanted to, you know, always like be authentic to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that really comes across. and that's a little bit about what we're going to talk about today, isn't it? That I think what you do is you talk so beautifully about real life as a Muslim woman. You know, it's you're not a romanticizer necessarily. You kind of dig into those quandaries of real life that you've experienced.
Yeah, definitely. Because it's really important to be honest and open, but at the same time, kind of not giving away everything that would, you know, maybe compromise other people's trust, you know, because often, you know, I'm talking about my family, and, you know, and it is very sensitive. And I think we spoke about this together when we were talking about these things. You know, we want to be so open, and we want to be personal. But, you know, you have to also respect the other people around you.
Yes.
So it's kind of a balance. It's finding a balance in that, and finding your voice as well through that.
Yes, because I think that's the eternal dilemma of the kind of memoirist or life writer. And definitely. I mean, I've been putting together these courses lately for people who write from life, and I absolutely love doing it. But I think one of the parts of that I've really wrestled with is the ethical component. Like, how do you teach people about the ethics of being someone who, like, when you write from your own life, you always touch on other people's, and that's crunchy, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I've often, sometimes when I've written pieces, I've actually had to, you know, just check with my brother or my sister or my mum and go, look, I'm talking about this. It's really personal to all of us. So is this all right? Is the way I'm saying this okay for you? And, you know, and often they're like, yeah, no, that's fine. Because I'm always conscious of that. That, you know, this is their emotions as well that I'm talking about. It's not only my own, because we have this shared grief or shared loss, you know, when we lost my father, for example. So, you know, conveying that in a public space it can be really daunting, but also it can be really empowering. You know, and sharing some of my experiences in public, you know, I've had the most incredible responses to it, you know, not only from strangers, but also from my own family members, because it's like you process your grief in a certain way. And I've certainly been able to do that. I've certainly been able to process, you know, those times in my life that have been traumatic or painful. And, you know, that writing, it really does help, as you completely know.
Yes.
You know, it really does help you kind of, you know, channel that. And I understand how you're feeling about those moments in hindsight and at the time. It's definitely my writing has definitely helped me, and I hope also my family members.
Yeah, and I mean, I sometimes get some kind of askance comments about why on earth I'd write about my own dirty laundry, essentially. It is hard. I mean, and that process of writing can be really painful and kind of gut-wrenching, and it drags out all your shame and all of your kind of self-loathing sometimes, and your grief. It's definitely, there's always stuff that surfaces that you still feel terrible about.
You're absolutely right. Like, you know, it is gut-wrenching. Like, when you're writing, it's not easy. It's not easy to write in this way, in this open way, and digging deep into your soul and just like bringing it out. You know, I was really nervous about some of the way it would be, the reactions to some of my writing. What I was saying, like, you know, when I The Guardian like commissioned me to write something, a moment that changed my life, or the one thing that worked. And I was like, well, you know, there are a few things, but like one of them was my broken engagement, where that just kind of went really bad. And like, you know, talking about that was difficult. And I was scared, and I was feeling a little bit sick about it, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So that's really great that we're going to talk about that today.
That's the segue.
You can feel sick all over again, Ramona. I'm giving you that opportunity right now.
Oh, that's good. I've got lots of clothes around me, so it's all right. I can absorb it.
I'm so glad you're in your protective wardrobe.
I am. My little room of my wardrobe.
But I read that article and I thought it was wonderful. That's why I wanted to talk to you about it. But I think one of the things that does, when I read about that story, is that it tells me a very different story about Muslim women that I guess we don't hear very much. And I think that's one of the really important things that life writing does. So tell me first of all about the plans you had. How did you meet your partner, and what was the deal?
Yeah, so this was a long, long time ago. I was in my 20s. I think I was around 24. So this is well over 15 years ago. And I, you know, as a good Muslim girl, I didn't really have any relationships at all growing up. I remember at school when we used to go to like, you know, parties or whatever, I used to stay away from everybody, and there was like all these kind of like discos, and I'd be sitting on the sidelines watching everybody else, those school discos. And, you know, and I was, you know, I was brought up with, you know, freedom and, you know, liberal values and Islamic values. And, you know, and I knew that, you know, boys were kind of off limits. So when I met my ex-fiancé, I was, you know, quite naive, bit of a romantic. And I met him outside of a traditional setting, which is like normally at that time we'd have people come over, you know, suitors come over to the house to meet you.
I love,
like,
that word, suitor.
Suitor. I know, it's so fantastic. Like archaic.
No, it sounds great. I'd love to have had suitors.
I know, it's like Jane Austen time or something, you know. So we used to have like people call up. There used to be some kind of like auntie network, and they would call up the house and call my mum and say, oh, I know a suitable boy who is, you know, whatever height, whatever like skin colour. It's so stupid.
Oh, wow.
There is so much colourism in the Asian communities as well. And then they would come over with their parents and probably their entire families sometimes. And we just sit very awkwardly in the living room and have samosas and tea and kind of chat marriage. And then
that sounds incredibly awkward.
Oh, it was so terrible. It was honestly the worst experiences of my life. Terrible. So when I kind of met my ex-fiance, it was beyond that setting. So I met him at some demonstration in London, my first demo that I went to, and I was like, right on. And it felt like, oh, this is it. This is free from all that kind of cultural setting. And this was like, I just met him and I quite liked him and he liked me. And yeah, and so I kind of was on cloud nine a little bit and couldn't believe that someone liked me as well. So that was a bit of a shocker.
Now.
You know, everything's so artificial normally, and you know, nothing was organic. So this kind of happened a bit more organically. So I was quite excited, and you know, told my parents about him. They weren't that happy because, you know, at the time he, you know, he didn't really have a good job. He didn't have a degree. Right. And, you know, with Asians, it's like, you know, you've got to, you know, give financial security to my daughter.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That for that reason, they weren't too happy. But, you know, when they saw how happy I was, they accepted it.
Mm.
And they were happy for me. And they told the world about it. And so the whole world knew about my engagement. Like, even the taxi driver, the local taxi driver knew about it. You know, that's just the nature of how, like, Asians are. They just, like, it's an entire community getting married when it's you getting married. You know, everyone is in on it.
Yeah.
So, and, like, actually throughout my you know, knowing him and my relationship with him, it was actually, there were so many alarm bells ringing that I kind of just dismissed, because I thought, no, I met him, and yeah. You know, I'm the one that brought him home, and you know, this can't be right, he's perfect, you know, I'm the issue. So I kind of dismissed a lot of those kind of doubts and those niggles about him. I don't really want to talk about
what the doubts are. That's
I'm going to focus on my own feelings. Of it,
that comes, you know, back to those ethics that we, yeah, that we kind
again,
of try
those
and build.
Ethics, yes. Those ethics are coming in. So I eventually kind of had this huge panic attack.
Right.
A week before our engagement, where couldn't breathe, I couldn't eat, and this all happened at his mother's house, and it was horrible. And my mum was with me, my sister, we'd gone like kind of shopping for like engagement gifts for each other. And I think that's where it came to a head, you see, because I kept, you know, brushing it under the carpet, thinking, oh, we'll be okay, I just need to get through this and get to the engagement. And then this huge, like, my body literally just, conked out.
Oh yeah, and I know that only too well. And I often I know all about those. In fact, by the time I left school, I couldn't get into school without having one of them. It was really fun times. But I often think that panic attacks are something that arrives when you're ignoring your you've ignored your feelings for too long, and your body just finds this way of going, no, come on, you know, here I am.
Yes, that's exactly what it was. It was like, okay, you're not listening to me, your mind is not listening, you're not listening to your mind, so right, I'm gonna make
you listen. Yeah,
it really did. Well, it almost did. So I kind of was pretty flawed at that time, but I was speaking to some members of my family, and I was just describing how I was feeling, and one of them, my brother, was like, I think you're basically depressed.
Wow. And your brother is a doctor, isn't he?
He's a doctor. Yeah, he's a doctor. And and he said, look, you know, do you want to go on pills? You know, do you want to have Prozac? Mm. Or I was like, listen, I don't want any antidepressants. I need to get through this in my own way.
Mm.
So I literally turned to my faith. That was the only thing I could cling to, because I felt like I was plunged into this place where it was just a dark place of complete loneliness. And I only had my faith. And there's this verse in the Quran that says that God is closer to you than your jugular vein. And I'd never felt the meaning of that until that time. Just that really came to me, because I felt like nobody was really hearing me. And so I kind of turned to my faith, but then I still went through with the engagement. And it was the unhappiest day of my life. I was just looking at the photos, so thinking, sad. I look dead behind the eyes.
Wow.
It's terrible. But you know, it was like a big party, because we don't do things by half. We had like a marquee in the garden, a cake. Like a wedding. It was like a mini wedding, and everyone in all my relatives in India knew, and everyone was calling. Oh my gosh, wow. It was just dreadful.
The stakes were so high.
Yeah. So yeah, it wasn't just, you know, my own kind of like trauma I was dealing with. It was like, you know, thinking about what kind of trauma and pain would I bring to everyone else as well if I say no and I can't do this. But I eventually did. I eventually did do that. And it was really, really, really difficult.
Right.
And I kind of lost sense of who I was in that process. I think you say so beautifully in your book, like, you fall into gaps of somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I was reading that thinking, I fell into the gaps of someone else. as
right.
well.
That's interesting.
You know, and I didn't recognize myself. I lost sense of who I was. I forgot how to smile. Oh, I kept beating myself up, you know, and I thought, how, you know, even I remember one uncle saying to me, we trusted you. We trusted your judgment. And he was just so surprised. And that made me feel even worse.
Wow, that's quite a harsh comment though, isn't it? Because
I know
does have that level of judgment about, I mean, that's, you know, choosing a partner is the hardest choice you'll, you know, if you position it as a choice, you know, it's the hardest thing to do because you just cannot tell everything about somebody else and you can't tell everything about yourself even. You don't know what you're going to feel like, you know, 10 years down the line. It's a tricky, tricky decision to make, really.
Oh, totally, totally. And it's kind of almost unforgivable in a way. with me, I certainly couldn't forgive myself for a really long time because I thought, you know, I've brought everybody to this point. It's my fault. You know, I didn't trust my judgment early enough, you know, and I was the one who's pushing it because I was this silly romantic who was totally inexperienced. And, you know, I just beat myself up way, way too much. Mm. And also there was this time where I thought, okay, now I need to choose. Just before I made the decision to break it off, I was like, I literally have destiny in my hands. Like, what do I choose? Wow. You know, do I, you know, whatever I choose is my path. So I was like, okay, so do I break it off or do I go for it? Because actually, in a way, breaking it off was much harder.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, doing it would have been easier because it would have been the easy one. But then ultimately, it would have been the worst thing for me. So I just had to do it completely on my own. And I decided, and it took me a long time to recover. I think the first time I smiled was about 3 months later or something.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was really bad. I'm laughing now. But, you know, it was extraordinarily difficult and dark. And, you know, I didn't even say the word depression, really, until much, much later.
Yeah.
Because it's something that you think, this doesn't happen to me. It happens to other people. You know, why would it happen to me? But I do now recognize that I was depressed.
I do you know what? I actually think we've forgotten that you and I come, I mean, like I'm 42, I'm not going to give your age away, but we're in the same class at school.
Well, you have now. So it's important to be honest, but not all the time.
Sorry, couldn't resist that one. But when we were growing up, like, depression was not normalised, I don't think. And it was not talked about in the way it's spoken about now. And I'm so grateful
taboo.
It was taboo. Ooh. And I had, you know, I was first diagnosed with depression when I was 16. And I remember a member of my family saying, "You can't be depressed. Like, that doesn't happen to people your age, you know." And I, you know, like, not only did I feel terrible because I was depressed, but also I felt terrible that I'd kind of bought this humiliation, which meant that we as a family were somehow faulty, you know, as well as me personally.
Feel that pain. I can feel it right now.
And I, you know, having to go into school and talk to it, you know, talk to kind of random teachers about it, you know, who our head of year was at that point, and whether you'd want to tell her about your depression. We forget how much that conversation's changed for the better and how much more open we are about it. But I can well imagine that.
And it's only recent, though, isn't it?
Very recent. Yeah. And I can imagine how hard it was for you to recognise it, you know, to see it for what it was, because the information wasn't really there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And when you're not really recognising it, you're kind of very scared of it.
Mm.
And, you know, and also with the whole cultural background, you know, it was even like a double taboo,
right?
And then like a triple taboo with like my Muslim background. But even though, you know, there is recognition of trauma and pain within that tradition, and, you know, and reassurance as well, which, you know, I only really found it in my faith. And you know, a lot of my friends were even like, you know, what's going on? Because I couldn't really explain what was going on. I kept saying, look, he's just not right for me. And I couldn't explain to them why, but there was something in my gut and in my core that was telling me, do not do this.
So
I was kind of even doing this guidance prayer. I was doing a guidance prayer at the time that Muslims do when they kind of want to take a decision.
Right.
And
that sounds handy. Can we all do that?
It is very handy. It's a very good get out clause as well. I've used, like, it's called like my kind of like God disclaimer. So I'm like, you know, it's not in my destiny. God hasn't written it for me. So, you know, I'm not meant to be with you. It basically kind of goes along the lines of, you know, if this thing is good for me, then, you know, bring me closer to it and, you know, make it good for me and my end. And then, and if it's bad for me, then just, you know, remove me from it and remove it from me. So, you know, but it's for people who are kind of a bit more uncertain. I kind of did it for an assurance that it was a confirmation of what I already felt deep down inside.
Yeah.
And it did. And every time I thought about breaking it off, I did feel some kind of relief. So that's why I did it. And very literally just a few months later, I broke off the engagement. And I remember telling my dad, like, I think it was Ramadan at the time. And
that's a good moment to pick.
A very good moment. I'm like, okay, this is a good month to use. And he, because he didn't know, my mum was like, you know, don't tell him yet, because, you know, he was so excited. And, you know, he was also not well at the time. So he, you know, he came home from the mosque. And I was waiting up for him, and I said, you know, Dad, I just need to talk to you. I just can't do this. Wow. I can't marry this guy. And he was literally held me, hugged me on the sofa. And it was just the most reassuring moment for me. Yeah. Like, he just said, like, don't worry about everything. I will sort everything out. I will tell everybody, you don't need to worry.
That gives
and
me
I
chills.
Was just like, oh, it was just the most of it. I was just crying. And and I just felt so much comfort and reassurance. And, you know, and he really did. He really, he kind of said he was the one that called it off.
Wow.
And, you know, he wrote letters to all, like, kind of the important relatives. And it just he took so much pressure off my shoulders. You know, and it was a way, it was kind of like, you know, trying to, like, so it comes from a kind of place of like authority as well, so that people won't question it so much. I'm like, oh, what's going on, what are you talking about, you know? So he kind of removed that for
me. Kind of shielded you. I mean, that's
shielded me,
a beautiful thing to give to your children, I think.
Yeah,
if you can just shield them from a little bit of harm while they're figuring the hard stuff out, I think that's a wonderful thing to do. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'll never, ever forget that. You know, and, like, people absorb your wintering as well. Like, you know, there is this, even for myself, there's an empathy of wintering where you take on other people's sadness and grief.
Mm.
And, you know, it does help. It's kind of distributed a bit more, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes that empathy, it just becomes your own winter, doesn't it? When people are going through that, because you're so close to that person.
You can take small bits away from people, can't you? You can just lift the burden and share it for a while. Yeah.
Sharing is, it really helps so much. And not only with your own family members, but also with, you know, with just general people. Mm. Like, you know, the article that I wrote had so many hits worldwide. It apparently had like 160,000 hits, like, in the first week or something. And, you know, so that means that there was this recognition. You know, people go through this pain. There's this collective sense of it. Collective sense of wintering going on, and the collective sense of the resilience as well. So people kind of saw that, and I got so many messages saying I've been through something really similar. And that kind of assured me, and at the same time really alarmed me, because I'm like, oh no, everyone's going through this pain. But at the same time, you're like, you know, this is life, this is what human beings go through. And you know, and these are all lessons, and they build us, you know, we have to be broken down in order to be built up again. And, you know, just to get, you know, have those scars, but, you know, you carry them with more wisdom and more kind of clarity, and, you know, going forward. So it's, you know, that was very overwhelming for me to, you know, to have that kind of empathy from people. And it, you know, you realize how deep it goes, you know, how deep these roots go in all of us.
It's that moment of feeling part of a big human community, which I think we glimpse so rarely, but often we glimpse that in our moments of intense pain, actually. And when we see other, and actually that takes me right back to what I was talking about when we started, about life writing just gives us those points of contact with other human beings and their humanity and their commonality with you.
Mm. That is the best writing, isn't it?
Oh, for when me, there is every resonance. Time.
When,
every
yeah,
time.
Like when people can recognize themselves and their emotions and their experiences in your words.
Mm.
You know, and it's the most incredible feeling.
What a privilege to be able to write that too. I mean, I'll never stop being grateful for for being able to put that most
Absolutely.
Painful material out there and to always have that, find a mirror that reflects me back at myself. I think that's just...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Like you that's it. That's exactly what it is. It is a mirror.
Mm.
And, you know, and also you're giving a sense of kind of, you're like honour to what you've gone through.
Yes.
There is a dignity to it, you know,
yes.
in the way you're conveying it. And, you know, and that is what people will also recognize. You're not just kind of like, I'm sending this all this stuff out there for sympathy and people kind of going, yeah,
going, oh,
I feel you,
poor
blood.
You,
you
yeah.
know, you know, there is integrity there. And, you know, people really appreciate that you're being authentic and
yes.
you're being open and you're being dignified about it as well.
Well, I think it yeah. returns dignity to it because often the whole experience is very chaotic and...
Yeah.
It's not ever, you never get your narrative arc, you know, you never get your kind of perfect sort of beginning, middle and end and sense of closure. But that creation of the story of it, I think, helps to reintegrate everything and returns the dignity to that, to the moment, I suppose.
Yeah, that was beautifully said. That was beautifully put.
I'm loving this. Definitely. This says everything to me about writing as a kind of spiritual practice, actually, and as an act of prayer, almost, as an act of...
Yeah,
worship
exactly
somehow of something that's bigger than you are, even if that's intangible.
You sound like a Sufi Muslim. That is exactly
that's
it.
That's never been said before, but I'll take it. Thank you.
It is sacred. Yeah, what we're writing is sacred because our existences are sacred.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, when and we are all spiritual beings, you know, whatever our beliefs are, we are all spiritual beings. And, you know, there is something deep within us that we need to convey to the world. And when people recognize that and there's a bridge there, there is a beautiful universality of spirit and love and compassion and understanding. And, you know, and I think, you know, your writing does that and it does it so beautifully.
I try very hard to do that, you know. Well, but only because
it's hard. You know, it is hard. It's not
really
easy.
Hard. But I also think, like, you know, like I come from an atheist kind of culturally Christian background, where spiritual.
Yeah.
I had no template for discussing my spiritual sense of the world, and was very wary of it too, because you know, religion was always taught to me as kind of control and something to be resisted. And so I kind of wanted to communicate with people like me who are a bit wary of anything that's got rules behind it, but who want that spiritual engagement with the world. That's definitely my aim. But it's very hard to talk about that in the UK specifically as well, I think. That conversation is much easier in America.
Yeah.
We're
Though there is a move towards like more, you know, spirituality via like kind of mindfulness and things like that. There is this need and yearning for it.
Mm.
You know, and for me personally, like, you know, I've been brought up in a religious setting and upbringing, but, you know, and I wasn't somebody like rules either. You know, and I never wanted to approach it like a set of do's and don'ts. You know, for me, it was just about expressing who I was. It was very liberating.
Mm.
You know, it was like, you know, seeing the beauty of my faith and seeing, you know, how it can open up so many doors to me and also make me really understand who I am and, you know, help me in self-development. So I kind of, that's how I approached my faith. And I still approach my faith in that way. I just see it as very dynamic and very nuanced. You know, people always try and put it in a box, and it really it does not belong in a box. You know, it belongs everywhere, and I think it belongs to everyone as well.
Yeah,
you know, because that's the sacredness in all of us.
And that's what lets you be of such service to other people as well. That's what you that's, you know, that's how you feed it back into the world. You know, you take in that wisdom and you go out and it helps. It helps.
Yes. That's exactly what the writing is all about as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you're doing. Like, it is a service. It's a service to yourself and to others.
Yeah.
And it is bringing benefit, you know, and that's why we do need to be honest. And you know, honesty is a challenge, but it ultimately it is something that is a human experience that everybody will appreciate and recognize.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll grow from each other's experiences. And, you know, I feel like, you know, you grow every time you read anything. There is a growth in there. It's definitely like a plant or a seed that just keeps growing and growing. And that's why I love reading other people's work and experiences. And I always want to know about everybody else's lives. I'm like, what's going on with you? Not in the way of like kind of celebrity gossip, but, you know, what people go through. Like, I think I was listening to, Sheryl Sandberg's?
Right.
Was it Desert Island Discs? Was it?
I hadn't caught that.
Oh, it was just, I think it was just about her losing her husband.
Right, yeah, that's Sheryl Sandberg, yeah.
And it was so, oh my God, you're crying with her. You're feeling that pain with her. And that recognition of pain is so important. Like, you know, I feel like grief personifies in each one of us, and it becomes like two people who recognize each other. You know, I guess, like, so, you know, me listening to what you've gone through and your loss, you know, it helps you, doesn't it?
Kind
of, you know, you do see it as a person,
yeah,
almost, you know.
And your grieving self meets other grieving selves, I think. Those two can always be in dialogue. Whenever you meet someone who's lost someone, those two parts of each person can always talk. There's always something
totally.
There.
Yeah. Even in the silence, like, honestly, like, your souls just, like, can hear each other.
Yeah.
It's just, it is incredible. And I felt that with, you know, one of my closest friends had a, you know, she lost her baby in a stillbirth, and it was one of the darkest moments of her life and of mine.
Yeah.
You know, because I kind of took on her pain and her trauma, and then, you know, it also happened in our own family when my sister lost her baby. And that also, again, because I was kind of almost prepared for it with my friend, it just happened recently before that loss. It kind of prepared me for that in a way. You know, but then the pain was so deep, like, you feel like
it's hard to imagine deeper pain than that.
You actually feel the heart breaking. It is actually feel the cracks. You felt the cracks. So I thought I knew pain and then, you know, pain's just like, yeah, no, this is how it feels, this is how it can really feel.
Yeah,
you know,
that's so life for you.
That is life.
You don't know pain, really, lady. Is.
yeah and just watching how my friend and my sister just, you know, came out of that and how they found the strength to come out of that was extraordinary, and it gave me strength as well. It was kind of like a symbiotic kind of relationship going on. Like, you know, we were kind of, I was supporting and then she was supporting me, and it was, yeah, it was extraordinary.
It's redemptive.
Extraordinary. This empathy is just, you know, of wintering is extraordinary.
It's a wonderful thing. This has been like the best conversation that I've had for years with anyone. I feel like I've got absolute chills. It's just so beautiful. And I just...
Me too.
Yeah, it's really lovely. We could just sit here and have a little cry now, couldn't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably will need to afterwards.
Maybe I might have a cup of tea in a minute. I want to ask you one final thing before we go off for our little individual cries. Did you come to a point after... many years after all the kind of pain and the embarrassment of breaking off that engagement and all of those, that big cluster of feelings and the confusion, did you ever come to a point of clarity about why you needed to do it?
Wow, that's a big one.
Sorry. Hey, we're doing big ones today. That's where we are.
Big endings, big endings. I think that I had clarity even around the time that I made the decision. But, you know, I knew that I was doing the right thing, so I never ever had regret about the decision that I made to break it off.
Yeah.
But the clarity, it became clearer as I went along, because I actually heard things that reconfirmed that I made the right decision from other people's experiences of that person. But, you know, for years, I couldn't forgive myself until I think this was many years afterwards. I kept beating myself up about it. And then I think I went to some talk by a Muslim scholar, and he said, look, you know, you keep asking God for forgiveness, but you need to forgive yourself. You need to know that that prayer has been accepted and answered.
Mm.
And then you've got to let it go. You just got to let it go. Because I kept praying over and over.
For the same,
I kept saying, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry, I've done this," and then there was a moment of release where I was like, "Okay, I'm not going to make this prayer. I'm not going to offer this prayer anymore. I'm going to let it fly. I've done it. I'm done with it, and I know that I've been forgiven, and I know that it set me free. Now, why am I chaining myself in this way? It was like shackles. You put invisible shackles on yourself, and that's my real moment of clarity."
And that's true faith that your prayers are actually answered, you know.
And believing in yourself that you made the right decisions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these what ifs and why didn't I do this? And, you know, they just destroy you.
Mm.
And you need to nurture yourself, not kill yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so it really helped me. And actually that entire experience now, it was a huge lesson for me, and it built up who I am. It really did, because it enabled me to kind of dive deep into my emotions and to understanding myself better.
Oh, I can tell. I mean, I, you know, like when you meet someone that you knew kind of then and now, I think you're probably more aware of the contrast than most, but you are so... Oh, I don't know. Self-actualized is a really naff term.
Oh, let's do it.
But you inhabit yourself fully in a way that not many people do, I don't think. And it just shows. It shows. You've grown so much wisdom since I last knew you, and it's extraordinary.
Yeah, since I was that silly girl at school.
Oh, weren't we all? Oh, my days.
I really appreciate that, though. No, I do. That was really lovely, really nice to hear. And I'm taking it, and I'm going to, like, take that soundbite and play it back to myself every morning.
Yeah, I wish I'd used self-actualized now. I just feel like that's naff language. But you know what I mean. My heart was in the right place.
No, I completely know what you mean, though. Like, there is this... There is a comfort there, and a confidence in who you're, in who you are, in your sense of self. And it's a constant journey, though, Catherine. I have to say, like, I still get so much self doubt, and, you know, confidence issues and anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's a constant battle. But you know what your strengths are, you know what your weaknesses are better, you know, at this time in our lives than, you know, perhaps when we were at school or in my 20s when I was going through that experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of a journey into yourself is so, so crucial and so revealing. And these emotions, you know, we're still learning within them. Like, you know, I don't know what love is still. I still don't know what grief really is. You know, it's a constant learning curve and a constant journey.
I just think that we don't talk about ourselves as a work in progress enough. And like, if we ever give each other the impression that anyone can be fixed and have it sorted once and for all, then we're doing great harm.
Definitely, the
journey is the point, and
we haven't got it sorted. It's not like, oh yeah, I've done that and now I know everything, you know.
I don't even want to get it sorted. I mean, can you imagine how boring it would be if you had it sorted? But we carry on kind of cycling through change, and every time we cut, it's a spiral rather than a circle, so we move up a little bit maybe, hopefully, if we take enough time to reflect, but maybe we don't always manage to do that. But it's never going to stop. That's not the point of this, you know? That's absolutely not how this works. And I think that too much of our culture talks about, okay, here's how it's done, like stuff solvable. And that is, that we have to start seeing that as totally undesirable and totally unwise and totally cold. It's not even interesting to me at all. I like the work.
Yeah, it's not. It is. I mean, it was. It's what keeps us alive, really, isn't it? Mm. You know, and ticking, and you know, it's. It, oh, I just thought of something really clever to say, and it's gone now. I was like, oh, I thought of something, and it's literally gone. But just think, it was going to be the best thing. It was going to be the best thing on this podcast.
I know I'd have felt nourished by it.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. Amazing. I'm so sorry. I don't know where it went. It went somewhere.
No, we felt it. We felt it. You downloaded it. It's fine. We've all got it. Yeah.
Did you feel it?
I did.
Basically, whatever you said, I'll just say that again.
Oh, Ramona, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me and for just saying such amazing things that have given me chills. It's just been wonderful. Thank you.
Likewise. Everything you've said has just been beautiful and spectacular and meaningful. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been wonderful.
And that's all for this week's episode, and indeed for this first series. Thank you to everyone who's listened, and thanks again to all my brilliant guests. I promise you there are many more lined up for the autumn. If you've loved the wintering session so far, please click like or subscribe to help others to find it too. And don't forget, my book Wintering is available in all good bookstores. See you in a couple of months.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.